are involved in them in many different ways. So what is that number, right? Is it 3%? Is it 5%? Is it 7%? That was one of the comments we made, even with the use of another. The credit card industry wanted to have some operating rules for credit cards. What is the percentage that then the industry should act to say it's enough of a volume that we should look to see how do we have policies and operating rules potentially or standards around this? So the answer is yes, we're looking at it, but we don't know what that level is, what that volume is to act on it. It might be something that would be really useful for this committee to think about. What do you think that number is? First, we got to make sure we have the right tracking numbers, and then we need to say what's going to drive us. What is that trigger that drives the change?
Maybe a couple of points on that. There's no question that the ACO model and patients have a medical home model, it's going to be a lump sum payment in most cases. There's no reason why that couldn't be, again, an EFT ACH payment. And when I think about meaningful use, the vast majority of those payments were made through as if it was a Medicare payment. And, Walter, to your earlier point, even though providers are sort of carved out from the requirements, that's not the approach that some health plans are taking. So Medicare, for example, requires EFT. Another major health plan I've heard last week is going to be transitioning away from pay for checks. So I see this trend accelerating, and it'll put more pressure on the providers to adopt these standards. The nice thing about EFT is you don't have to have any technology in the practice. You can have all paper-based, but who doesn't have a bank account? So I think it's a very low-hanging fruit, very easy one for providers to take advantage of. Why haven't they? Well, because of the enrollment issues, the fear of recoupment, which I think is a sort of old wives' tale in the industry, that an overpayment would be scooped out of their account by the health plan. So education is going to be important, but the trend is clearly there, I think.
Thanks, Mark. Before I wanted to ask if Janet on the phone, do you have any comments on the last couple of questions, if you wanted to provide any thoughts on those?
Walter, I don't have additional ones other than the ones that have been expressed. I mean, from a payer perspective, we want providers to adopt all the electronic transactions. We have not forced it. I know payers who have, as far as the EFT is concerned. We have chosen to use the carrot approach and just encourage. But, you know, we are spending millions of dollars on mandates, and it is beneficial to us if the providers adopt them.
Well, that was very helpful. Thank you.
I'm not sure I really want to ask this question right before we're all about to go to break, because it might be an easy, simple question, or it might not be. Just because there's no mandate to adopt an acknowledgement, but yet there's clamor across the industry for years to get a standardized adoption of an acknowledgement, and we've debated the 997 versus the 999, why can't we adopt a mandate for acknowledgement? I mean, what's really blocking us as OESS and the rest of the industry from getting behind that bandwagon?
Well, I think there's a philosophical discussion that's actually happening now with a lot of e-health, whether it's meaningful use, whether it's administrative simplification, whether it's pay for performance. And so the question becomes, what is the optimal way of doing business, and is it really regulation? And so I've actually had a conversation, several conversations over the last few weeks, and I literally hear the split. Too much regulation, and so is there another way of not doing regulation but moving the industry and the healthcare industry forward, and that includes CMS and all other payers and federal plans. Two, I also hear, well, in terms of, like, infrastructure or this kind of interoperability, and it's not just OESS, it's of course ONC and others, which is, oh, I think you need to regulate a bit more in order to get that kind of standardization and meet and arrive at that holy grail. So I think, quite frankly, it's this committee and others in order to have that discussion, because I don't think it's been resolved, and I have a feeling it's going to require an ongoing conversation and discernment. It's like it's almost like splitting hairs. So which route should we have? Because we have several routes: regulatory, sub-regulatory, just payment policy. Payment policy. That's a big incentive. So I just want to put it out there that I don't have the answer, or we don't have the answer. I think we need to have a mechanism, and maybe what we were talking about in terms of infrastructure, how we discuss what is optimal, and what is the optimal strategy, is a way of doing it rather than just be simply prescriptive. So that's. I'm trying to.
Thank you. I would agree with Rob. It is that public-private partnership. And one of the things with core certification, it requires acknowledgement. So when Janet Jackson from North Carolina said she's core certified, it means for eligibility, she's using them claim status, now ERA. So there is that public-private piece. And I think there's also the discussion, is it truly an infrastructure? So do you need a standard? Do you need a standard, or is it just an infrastructure piece? We've had a legal debate about this, which a lot of people say it doesn't stand alone as a transaction, so it's not a standard, because it's only sent if you send a standard. So is it really just part of the infrastructure, and how far do you need to go with the regulation as a result? So I think there's a few different ways to look at it. Rob put it well.
Just to inject some irony, when you look at the MedLearn Matters article discussing the March 3rd to 7th front-end testing week for ICD-10, you'll notice that the transaction that CMS is going to send back to the direct submitter will be, Rob, correct me if I'm wrong, the 277CA and the 999.
That's correct.
So it's ironic that they're accelerating their use of it, yet sort of... I certainly understand, we don't want to be over-regulated. Certainly we complain here at the table about regulations, but there are some that suggest ROI on both sides, and I think the acknowledgement is clearly one of those.
And just say, not to add to that more a little bit, but if you think about HTTPS, right, it's a standard that everyone uses, and so therefore it ended up in the infrastructure. We didn't have a big debate about it, because we all use it. Is it headed in that direction for acknowledgments, and therefore is there a different way to look at it versus just the typical standard?
Except it's been a debate for years.
Right.
It needs to go away. I mean, it's a basic function of doing business to say, I got it, thanks, and move on. I mean, without the confirmation, you don't know. So I think that we need to find that sweet spot, and it might actually go back to some of the things that Av was talking about, setting those boundaries to not prevent innovation and sort of let things advance. But it's going to be a hard sweet spot, having been involved in this conversation, some of the irony of not being involved in the whole HIPAA world for a bunch of years, and we're still talking about the same issues related to claims, attachments, and acknowledgments. I mean, I realize it's painful to make standardization, but we've tried to let the industry self-regulate and advance itself, and that's how we got HIPAA in the first place. It's a pendulum swinging, and hopefully maybe we can find something to kind of stop it from swinging and let us get moving forward with not spending so much time responding to regulations and focusing on the core businesses.
Agreed.
Okay, well, what a way to start the morning. I really want to thank everyone for your testimony. This was an exceptionally wonderful panel. We rarely actually end on time. This is something that never ending on time, but we are on time, and So we are going to take a 15-minute break to get into our next very important panel on ICD-10. So thank you again. And thanks, everyone. Janet, thank you so much for joining by phone. You're welcome to stay on the call for the remaining of the discussion. Thank you. People on the phone, first of all, I just want to make sure you can hear as well. Can someone acknowledge on the phone?
That's Walter, we can hear.
Great, thank you.
I'm calling out, yes.
All right, and I know there's a couple of people that are moving in this panel participating from via phone. And also, I just wanted to check if Linda Claus was able to make it on the phone. Are you on the phone, Linda?
Looks like she's having a problem.
She was joining on WebEx, actually. All right. So we're going to start with panel number two. And we have a very large number of testifiers. So, again, thank you for taking the time to meet with us today and present your testimony. We really appreciate it. The topic, as you know, is on ICD-10, achieving a successful transition. We're about, 8 months from the deadline of compliance, and so we wanted to take a check on the transition process and how to really move towards a successful completion of this transition. So with that, I think we wanted to start with some remarks from CMS. Oh, yeah, that's an update from Matthew, and then we'll go down that list. So, Matthew.
Thank you. And thank you, Subcommittee, for the opportunity to talk today. We're looking forward. We're actually very excited about this panel to hear about this discussion, and I think we have some exciting news all the way around. I just wanted to clarify that we're Office of eHealth Standards and Services under CMS, and so we're the regulators. We also do a lot of the outreach and education on ICD-10, but later in the panel you'll hear from our cohorts in Medicare and Medicaid, and they can talk about those specific questions. So I'm just talking as a regulator, and despite any of the rumors, this week's rumors, the date is set. No delays, October 1st of this year. So we'll just clarify that one more time, and we'll open every one of our discussions with that. I'd like to say that CMS, of course, is taking this implementation very seriously. We're meeting on a weekly basis with the administrator, reports to the White House. We're meeting with the administrator with, again, our cohorts in Medicare and Medicaid and the various CMS agencies. We're also, in OESS, having ongoing discussions, weekly discussions, with industry. Industry sectors, clearinghouses, vendors, providers, the associations. And we're using this as a kind of biofeedback to get a pulse of where the industry is in terms of readiness, but also to hear about issues and things that we can clear up with questions, ways that we can customize and tailor our education and outreach. Denicia here in a minute is going to talk about a technical assistance plan that's targeted at providers, specifically small providers, and this all comes from a kind of ongoing discussion with industry. If you all, I think many of you have probably been involved in those discussions. If you haven't been involved in those discussions, please come talk to me or Denicia or any of our staff in the back there, and we'll be happy to pull you in and keep those lines open. The other thing I just want to touch upon is the tremendous amount of tools and resources that have derived both from these discussions with industry and that we've collected over the years. I urge everybody to go to the CMS website and look at the resources. Really, with this final push, our emphasis is on providers, specifically small providers. To that end, you'll see that this week we're coming out with the Administrative Simplification Transaction Testing Checklist. That providers, as well as other industry sectors, health plans, and clearinghouses can use. Some of you, many of you, may have been involved with the pilot that produced this document. It was a pilot that CMS sponsored, run by NGS, many industry representatives. to talk about the different levels and define the different levels of testing, and from that pilot derive these checklists. And, you know, I think the checklist probably gives it a disservice, because you pick up one of these checklists, say, for the provider, and it points to all sorts of resources throughout the industry and CMS that can help providers in the various sectors to get to where they need to go. So, again, I'd urge everybody to take a look at our resources. And then the other big tool and resource that we're excited about is this physician practice technical assistance. And I'm going to turn it over to Denicia Reed here, who is our team lead for the ICD-10 implementation.
Well, good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining us today. I just wanted to say that this ICD-10 implementation has been very much a collaborative effort across the board. We know that it's going to take all parts of the healthcare industry to make this work. And so we're talking about providers, we're talking about clearinghouses, vendors, payers, and alignment across the healthcare industry to ensure that this goes off successfully. One of the things that we've been doing, as Matt mentioned, is actually inviting industry stakeholders into our internal meetings, talking through risk planning, talking through how we can be proactive in reaching the provider community, and offering up solutions and best practices and maybe some of those lessons learned out there, and share that across the board. And so that's really the intent of inviting groups to the table to talk through that. And I see many of you around the table that's been part of those discussions, and will continue past the implementation and into post-implementation. So today I'm going to walk through our small physician practice tool. And as Matt mentioned, we're developing a lot of outreach and education and technical assistance and training. And the reason is we're not developing it because, you know, it's fun to do. We're actually wanting to develop something very meaningful and useful to the provider community. A lot of these tools and resources that we mentioned are very much industry-inspired. There are suggestions by the industry where there's a gap out there that we need to fill. And so this is one of them. We've heard from some of the small physician practices. We've been hosting a couple of focus groups. We've been actually talking with small physician practice offices and doctors and nurses and other clinical staff about what is actually needed, what tools do they need to be successful in this. And so I'd like to walk through a little bit of what we're kind of laying out over the next couple of months. What you see here is our local field training and support for providers. I will mention that we are launching training in 50 states and several territories. We are highlighting 18 states. I hope that you can see them behind me here. California, New York, Texas, you name it. It's a number of those that we will actually be on site working very closely with the medical societies in those states, including a number of associations and partners that are coming to the table to be a part of this. We're actually going into some small physician practice offices and bringing together sort of coalitions at the community level. We know very much that this has been a national effort. We really want to get to the regional and local level and ensure that everyone has the information and is equipped with the tools that they need to transition. So in terms of timelines, we've been developing a small physician practice tool that actually helps the provider and the small physician practice develop their plan. They can develop that. They can delegate that to staff. They can develop a team if a team is there for a medium or large practice. For those solo physicians or small physicians, then they also see the task that needs to be completed in order to achieve ICD-10 implementation. The tool includes primers for ICD-10, clinical scenarios, clinical documentation scenarios, common codes across the board, and that was pulled by several data sources, including Medicare, Medicaid, and other commercial
sources across the board. I will just mention here that we are actually launching our Wave 2, Phase 2, in February, end of February, so we'll start to see a lot of activity at the local levels. We'd be happy to kind of share where we are and ask that you push that information out to your local partners as well. We also have what we're calling the Implementation Training Center. And what this is an opportunity for us to actually reach out into the community, identify some community champions, physicians of small physician offices, or office managers that's willing to sort of spread the word, talk through ICD-10, and achieve some best practices and sharing of those best practices. So we'll be actively calling, talking with physicians, staff, coding, billers, you name it. Here's the contact approach. I know it's very small, so bear with us, but it just shows the breadth of the types of organizations we're reaching out to, payers, clearinghouses, other federal agencies, associations, you know, the MACs also, state Medicaid agencies, QIOs, the RECs, you name it. And this is not an exhaustive list. This is very much a preliminary list, and we would invite your organization to be a part of this as well. We hope to have more than one page here and to expand this list. And here are some of the upcoming events. We're actually finalizing a lot of these, but we are working closely with the medical societies. This is where the physicians have told us that we need to be in contact with these organizations to really get to them and get the word out. And with that, I will end and turn the next part of this over to our next speaker.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for letting me come and speak today. My name is John Evangelist. I work with Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, and I'm responsible for the software management group overseeing the Medicare fee-for-service claims processing software. And I was asked to speak today to talk a little bit about our ICD-10 preparedness and our approach to ICD-10. The implementation of ICD-10 represents a significant code-set change that impacts the entire healthcare community. As the implementation date approaches, CMS is taking a comprehensive four-pronged approach to preparedness and testing to ensure that CMS, as well as the Medicare fee-for-service provider community, is ready come October 1st, 2014. The four-pronged approach includes CMS internal testing of its claims processing systems, beta testing tools for the provider community, acknowledgement testing, which was mentioned earlier, and announcing today end-to-end testing. First, CMS internal testing. CMS is a very mature and rigorous testing program for its Medicare fee-for-service claims processing systems that supports the implementation of four quarterly releases per year. Each release is supported by three-tiered and time-sensitive testing methodology. Alpha testing is performed by each one of our maintainers for approximately 4 weeks. The next step in that SDLC is beta testing, which is performed by a separate integration contractor for approximately 8 weeks. Finally, the user acceptance testing, which is performed by our administrative contractors, is performed for approximately 4 weeks, and part of the work that they do is smoke testing and to ensure that local coverage determinations are being met and the systems are functioning as expected. CMS Medicare fee-for-service began installing and testing ICD-10 changes in 2011. As of October 1st, 2013, all Medicare fee-for-service claims processing systems were ready for ICD-10 implementation. CMS continues to test, however, all software changes with each quarterly release. Second, provider-initiated beta testing. To help the provider community prepare for ICD-10, CMS recommends that the provider community leverage the variety of beta versions of its software that include ICD-10 codes, as well as national coverage determination code crosswalks to test the readiness of the provider systems. The following testing tools are available for download from the CMS website and include national coverage determinations converted from ICD-9 to ICD-10, the ICD-10 Medicare Severity Diagnosis-Related Groups Conversion Project, along with payment logic and software replicating the current MSDRGs, which use the General Prevalence Mapping, or GEMS, to convert ICD-9 codes to ICD-10. Versions of the current ICD-10, MSDRG Grouper, Medicare Code Editor, and MSDRG Definitions Manual allow analysis of payment impact from the conversion of the MS-DRG from ICD-9 to ICD-10. A pilot version of the October 2013 integrated outpatient code editor utilizing ICD-10 CM, the final version of the IOCE utilizing ICD-10 is scheduled to be released August 2014. Crosswalks for local coverage determinations will be available in April 2014. CMS encourages providers and submitters to utilize these tools as they test ICD readiness of their own systems. Providers who will not be able to complete the necessary system changes to submit claims of ICD-10 code by October 1, 2014 should investigate downloading the free billing software that CMS offers from their MACs. The software has been updated to support ICD-10 codes and requires an internet connection. Alternatively, many MACs offer provider internet portals, and a subset of those portals offer the ability for providers to submit professional claims. Professional providers that bill to a MAC whose portal offers this functionality should register for the portals to ensure that they have the flexibility to submit claims this way as a contingency plan. Third, acknowledgement testing, which was mentioned earlier today. In November of 2013, CMS announced that it will offer ICD-10 acknowledgement testing from March 3rd to March 7th. This testing will allow all providers, billing companies, and clearinghouses the opportunity to determine whether CMS will be able to accept their claims with ICD-10 codes. While test claims will not be adjudicated, the MAC will return an acknowledgement to the submitter, or a 277A, confirming whether the submitted test claims were accepted or rejected. For more information about acknowledgement testing, we recommend that you visit your MAC website. CMS is exploring the possibility of offering other weeks of acknowledgement testing after it analyzes the results of the March testing. And then finally, end-to-end testing. In the summer of 2014, CMS will offer end-to-end testing for a small sample group of providers. CMS defines end-to-end testing as the submission of test claims to CMS with ICD-10 codes and the receipt of a remit device explaining the adjudication of those claims, or submit to remit. The goal of this testing is to demonstrate that providers or submitters are able to successfully submit claims containing ICD-10 codes to the Medicare fee-for-service claim systems. CMS software changes made to support ICD-10 result in appropriately adjudicated claims based on the pricing data available for the testing purposes. And finally, accurate remittance devices will be produced. The small sample group of providers participating in end-to-end testing will be selected to represent a broad cross-section of provider types, claim types, and submitter types. Additional details about end-to-end testing will be disseminated at a later date, and I believe it's already been, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe it's been pushed out this morning.
Correct.
Okay. So that concludes my remarks.
Thank you so much, John. And thanks, Matthew, also. And thank you for your testimony. I think we have Godwin, is it? Godwin Odia from CMS on the phone?
Yes.
Can you go ahead with your testimony? I think
this is Godwin Odia. Greetings, everyone, from San Francisco, California. My name is Godwin Odia. I'm the CMS lead responsible for supporting the state Medicaid agencies and territories of the United States in their ICD clinical medication. I would like to have been here to meet with all of you in person, but I am in San Francisco, regional office, where my team and I are conducting an ICD training workshop for the state Medicaid agencies that comprise the San Francisco and Seattle region. The technical assistance we are providing a little later in the presentation.
Sorry. Could you hold on? We're trying to get your presentation materials.
This morning. Oh, it's not up yet.
Sorry about that.
Okay.
We have a paper copy for some of for the members here of the presentation.
Okay, I sent an electronic copy.
Yeah, the electronic copy is being connected right now. I'm sorry.
Okay. All right. I'll wait.
Sorry about that.
No problem. Just let me know when to start, because I've not seen anything.
Good. Okay, so now we're on, I think we can move to slide two on the presentation, and you were...
Yes, slide two.
And that's your nice picture.
That's me right there.
We can see you very well.
to slide three.
Thank you.
Yes. The topic I'll be speaking on today includes ICD-10 implementation timeline, development of the fiscal policy, Medicaid agencies, an overview of the technical assistance PMS is providing to the state Medicaid agencies and territories of the United States. The five operational requirements that PMS has identified as being the critical success factors that states must be able to perform on October 1, 2014. And the testing requirement, risk mitigation planning, current focus of PMS technical assistance to the state, and then some closing thoughts. At this starting point, I would like to share with you a high-level overview of the state ICD-10 implementation timeline. Next slide, please. One of the first areas of technical support provided to the state was a detailed ICD-10 implementation handbook and timeline. The handbook was organized in five implementation phases to include awareness, assessment, remediation, testing, and transition. As you can see, as of January 1 of this year, state Medicaid agencies should have been in the testing phase of their ICD-10 program. Next slide. CMS has been providing technical assistance to the state Medicaid agencies since 2009. With a dedicated team consisting of subject matter experts, experienced in Medicaid operations, ICD-10 trainers, and certified coders. Healthcare professionals to include a physician, registered nurses, health information management, business analysts, and project management professionals. Technical assistance has been at the strategic and granular level. Topic area are covered in concert with the PMS industry ICD-10 implementation timeline. Broad categories of technical support include a comprehensive implementation handbook, order how to guide, and as part of the material we review by the Medicaid Medical Director Training Network, other professionals such as AAPC, WIDI, and the American Health Information Management Association. We also have facilitated forums, a bi-weekly forum, and specialty discussion groups, dedicated websites, and monitor mailbox. To receive questions from the state. Many of the tools have been made available for public use through the CMS website under ICD-10 resources. Next slide, please. In-depth training has been a major area of support for the state. Today, CMS has conducted 67 training sessions on-site at CMS regional offices and individual state Medicaid agencies. Training syllabus included need to know topics applicable to all states, as well as sessions customized to meet the informational and operational needs of each individual state agency. A little further along the presentation, I will review the training workshop that we have just launched this week. Next slide, please. Next slide. In recognition of the impending implementation date, the emphasis of technical assistance has progressed to the topic of risk planning and testing. In particular, CMS is working with states to ensure their ability to perform high business operations required to support ongoing Medicaid services and operations during the transition. The five critical operational requirements that must be fully functional on October 1, 2014 include ability of state to accept electronic claims using ICD-9 and 10 codes based on date of service and date of discharge. Adjudicate claims, state institutional and professional provider, as well as managed care organization. Complete coordination of energy with Medicare and others. And to submit Medicaid eligibility and state program data to CMS using the Medicaid statistical information system, as well as the new transformed Medicaid statistical information system. All states are required to develop risk mitigation plan for each of the critical operational requirements, regardless of their anticipated ability to perform the function on the implementation date. Medicaid test requirement with the state will center on the high physical or personal requirements. Additional internet central office working with the regional offices for K-level test results and reports that will assist in assessing whether the high physical or personal requirement will be met. Next slide. At another area, January 1, 2014 was the official start of the testing phase for SMA, the State Medical Agency, in accordance with ICBCM project timeline. Teams are required to report to CMS the projected part and stop date for both internal and external testing and the status of their test plan. As a component of their testing with CMS, we need to ensure their ability to satisfy the five critical operational requirements. Teams are also required to conduct testing with external stakeholders, their own external stakeholders. Hotels in the area that have State Medical Agency as their business partner, I encourage you to reach out to those states that you need to test to determine where they are in this process. Next slide, please. In addition to the risk mitigation planning for each of the critical success factors I just spoke to, states are responsible for defining risk mitigation plans related to provider readiness. This is an area that states have reported a primary concern with. Without social media is working with the state to define risk mitigation specific to their provider regimen. Additionally, CMS is working with the state to identify the best methods to monitor claims performance early in the ICBP transition period to determine indications of an unintended impact to the integrity of the case plan. Next slide. The 2014 focus area. Providing technical support in the area of testing and risk mitigation planning, CMS also communicates on a regular basis to the state to understand their current technical support needs. CMS closely monitors its ICD-10 project progress with the common process that includes the federal state Medicaid self-reported readiness assessment and detailed one-on-one conference call with each state. This ongoing monitoring and communication with the state is leveraged to inform the type of technical assistance expected to be of the greatest value to the state. Next slide. This week, CMS began another cycle of training. States and territories of the U.S. will convene a five regional office for a two-day training workshop. The first of this workshop is now in progress here in San Francisco. The workshop agenda covers the topic that reflects the current testing phase of the implementation and will also be forward thinking and introduce the topic of post-ICD-10 implementation opportunities and impact. Additional technical assistance is planned for five-state Medicaid agencies with the largest Medicaid beneficiaries, including California, Florida, New York, Texas, and Illinois, as well as states that are already behind on their project timeline. Additional technical assistance will be targeted based on the ICD and implementation needs of each designated state Medicaid agency. Next slide. What's important to many of you, state Medicaid agency stakeholders engagement is a key requirement for the state and is specified in the state Medicaid implementation handbook. States are responsible for reporting to CMS the status of stakeholder engagement quarterly. As CMS does not disclose specific project status, I encourage those of you that do business with the state to reach out to them to continue to coordinate your ICD-10 project efforts. Many of the articles that have been developed for states are available to you through the CMS website. In conclusion, I want to assure the audience that CMS is committed to supporting states as well as the territories at all levels of ICD-10 readiness through implementation, through compliance day, and post-compliance. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for that testimony. Thank you very much. We're going to move to Jim.
Good morning. We're getting the slides up here. For those of you attending virtually, I'm Jim Daly. Just to being chairman of WEDI, I'm also a co-chair of the IC10 work group. So next slide, please. For those of you not familiar with WEDI, We are an industry organization, represent a broad group of stakeholders across all segments of the industry, and we're named advisors to HHS and the HIPAA regulations. Next, please. Today I'm going to have a couple slides of just general comments about our survey that we did in October of last year. I'm going to have detailed survey results, which I'll go through really quickly because I have a very short time limit here. And then closing comments will be some thoughts, recommendations, responding to the questions of the committee. Next, please. Actually, two forward. Okay, this is our eighth survey. We conducted it in October of last year and published the results to OESS in December. It was about 6 months after last survey. And what we were looking to see is the industry catching up on meeting the compliance state? We all knew it was falling behind, so we had hopes that maybe we'd see some movement forward. Also, we wanted to talk about how much external testing is being planned. That's been a really hot topic. How are we going to test ICD-10 since it's a broad impact to everyone? So we asked some questions related to that. It was a voluntary survey, so it's not necessarily statistically valid. But we got several hundred responses. We had, I think it's like 353 total responses. The issue with our surveys is we send them out to a bunch of groups, and the ones that respond tend to be those that are more aware, more ready. So this is probably on the brighter side of the spectrum than if you actually surveyed randomly hundreds of people out there across the country. Next slide, please. So I mentioned we have 353 total. This was down from a year prior to that. We'd done a survey, had over 2,600 responses. So there's less enthusiasm at this point, it appears, about saying where you are, especially if you're not as far ahead as you'd hope to be. It's either about 59 vendors, 98 health plans, and 196 providers. And there were a mix across all of those segments in there. One thing in this one, the providers was leaned a little bit more towards the institutional side. The prior ones seemed like more of the smaller practices were responding to that one. Next slide, please. Overall observations, what we saw is the industry is making some progress. It's slow progress, though, and it's not what we need to really make this thing work smoothly on October 1st. I'm not sure that's a surprise to anyone. Health plans and providers are completing their impact assessments. As we know, that's about time that they are doing that. And even that, they're not all done at that point. Remediation and internal testing is beginning, but some organizations lag behind in those and will not complete them until this year, until 2014. Some vendor products weren't ready. I have a couple slides on that. And the industry, in the summation, they won't have enough time for internal and external testing to prevent significant disruptions. So everything's boiling down to the last minute. What's the last thing you do? You test and put it into production. So that's the part that's going to suffer as a result of delaying these earlier steps. Okay, if you could advance one, two, three, four slides, please, to vendor results. When do you have, that's the one. When do you plan to have your services ready to customers? More than a third did have them ready as of October, so that was great. But it was only a slight increase over the February survey, so they weren't moving along really fast, but some did have them ready. However, two-fifths, 40%, said they wouldn't be ready until 2014, which doesn't leave a lot of time to get them installed, working, and then do testing with your trading partners. If you could move forward one, two more. Health plans, about three-fifths had completed their impact assessment. This is one of the first things you need to do. Figure out where your gaps are and figure out the workload in front of you. They still haven't finished that. So they're more than the last time we did it, but if they weren't done by that point in time, they're really far behind the curve. And I did talk to a consultant friend who in early January had just been hired by a small payer to start doing an impact assessment. So there's some organizations out there that are significantly behind. If you move forward, one, two, three, four, please. Estimated date to begin external testing. Some had already started that or expected to start it by the end of the year, so that's a good sign that in 2013 some external testing was starting to occur. All right, I've got to move along. But most were pushing it off till the end, till 2014. And if we could move forward to, well, I'll just cover this quickly. Providers, They had a lot of unknown results in the earlier survey. Now they knew the answers, but the answers were 2014 is when we're going to start doing these things.
Okay, if you could go to the closing comments, please. One more, please. There you go. I think that's it. Time is running out. No. Keep going, please. You're going the wrong direction, I think.
Okay,
there you go.
Go.
All right. So time is running out. So these are some actions I think the industry should be taking. And the first one they're taking very well. The compliance state is not changing. We've been hearing that for a year or two now, and we can't hear that enough. Emphasize the importance of communication and collaboration among the entities. Continue outreach and education. The fact sheets, issue briefs, great stuff on the CMS network out there, and Weedy has great tools, as many other organizations do as well. Certainly finish your impact assessments. Find out what you've got to do. If you don't know what you have to do, how are you going to start actually making the changes? Prioritize what you've got left. If your time is running out, you probably can't do it all, so pick and choose your battles. Focusing on clinical documentation improvements, testing. Another key item, get your metrics in place so you can start to measure what might be deviating from the norm once ICD-10 goes into place. Early detection means you can help fix whatever issues may arise a little bit earlier. Conduct your contingency planning and plan to mitigate the risks. The picture I've painted is the industry will probably not all be ready, so you got to deal with that situation. Figure out how you're going to handle various scenarios as they arise. And, of course, monitor progress. Anecdotal test results found that there are coding issues, people not using the codes correctly, at least at that point in time. There were some minor DRG shifts, so there's some things that can occur on that day. And last slide, please. Weedy plans to conduct additional surveys in 2014. Around March-April timeframe, we should have updated results on this one. We're working with CMS and other industry partners to engage the industry. We've got this HIPAA Success Initiative, a database of issues, concerns, not what is ICD-10, but things about as you go to implement this, what are the questions arising and how do you address those. We have state collaborators who brought together so the state collaborators can share their results and some of their best practices together. And we'll continue to do white papers, issue briefs, hold our monthly national calls, and our programming at conferences, et cetera. And thank you very much for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you so much. Next, we have Steve. Steve Herbert.
Just for clarification, it's Hebert. Looks like Hebert.
Hebert.
I want to thank the subcommittee for having me here today. My name is Sid Hebert. I'm the ICD-10 Program Director for Humana, with the primary responsibility for assisting our company with implementation of revised HIPAA electronic standards, IDC code set implementation, and administrative simplification mandated by the Affordable Care Act. Humana is headquartered in Louisville, Kentucky, for those who are not aware of that. We are one of the leading healthcare companies that offers a wide range of insurance products and health and wellness services that incorporate an integrated approach to lifelong well-being. Today, I am testifying on behalf of America's Health Insurance Plans. Humana began planning and execution of the ICD-10 remediation program in 2009 because we recognize that the complex coding system requires careful, systematic management for successful implementation. To date, Humana has completed remediation of its core processing platforms and is well into the internal and external end-to-end testing phase. Humana began its external end-to-end testing program, which is based on a select group of 70 large facilities in July of 2012. Currently, 30 of those facilities have entered our program and are progressing through our three-stage process. Humana expects to complete testing with approximately 66 of those 70 facilities. We began planning and design phases for our external professional and outpatient practices in January and anticipate that we'll begin provider engagement in the second quarter of this year. That we actually delayed initiation of that component of our testing because of significant micro-provider readiness to engage. On behalf of ATIP, I want to let the subcommittee know that we are committed to the implementation of ICD-10. Today I will address implementation dates, education and testing, provider readiness, as well as some important considerations regarding quality measures. I'm very pleased to hear the opening comments today because we do recommend the department and the standards committee continue to stress that October 1 implementation date will not change. Future delays will add additional cost and require a longer time frame for, in which we are operating dual systems. Beginning in October, we have to maintain dual ICD-9 and ICD-10 capable systems to account for the runout period of claims for services rendered prior to October 1st. Currently, we anticipate maintaining our ICD-9 compatible systems for approximately 18 months, only fixing system bugs or issues identified while we plan for reduced claims volume in the ICD-9 space. Operating these dual systems come at great administrative cost. Secondly, education and testing focus should transition from larger facilities, which in our view are predominantly ready, to smaller hospital and physician organizations. We are now deep into implementing testing for larger facilities in our network across the country. We have developed a three-stage methodology to help us and our providers understand financial implications of migration. Our testing is based on 350 core scenarios that are derived from deep analysis of areas where payment variation or major condition code variations might occur. And stage one is basically a coding test. Large facilities demonstrate that they can accurately code in ICD-10 by completing 10 basic scenarios as a coding test alone. The second stage is coding and mapping between ICD-9 and ICD-10. The purpose of this stage is to determine is the documentation within the facility sufficient to support ICD-10 coding. We select about 150 to 300 historical claims drawn from those 350 high-risk conditions, and ask them to recode in ICD-10 claims that they had previously submitted to us. We grade those and share the results with the providers. They move into stage three when they're ready to electronically submit claims. So stage three is our electronic claim submission or our production equivalent test. We then ask the 70 facilities to recode approximately 350 to 500 claims, once again chosen from the 350 top risk conditions, and send them to us electronically. Again, we evaluate those their responses and sit down at producing 835s, and we sit down and discuss any payment variations or any difference in expectations based on those results. Once we complete that, we consider the testing phase complete. Going through these three stages with large facilities will complete end-to-end testing in our view. However, it will not be possible to do this type of testing with all providers. We're not able to tell providers, and we are not able to tell providers exactly how to code, so it's imperative that they engage bilaterally with us. This is why it's so important that CMS greatly increases focus on provider training and outreach. Once again, encouraged to hear the comments today. The key to a successful rollout will be providers' understanding of how to correctly code claims using ICD-10. After all, folks, it is really all about the codes. This effort must focus on small and rural hospitals and small provider practices and should reinforce the importance of October 1 readiness this year. Humana has conducted provider surveys, readiness surveys, both November 2012 and again in November 2013, and the numbers of the readiness numbers were about the same. About 25% of providers have indicated that they will be ready for ICD-10. We surveyed in 2012 106,000 providers across all disciplines. And again, in 2013, we surveyed 130,000 providers across all disciplines. We had statistically relevant samples in most categories. So we feel confident that the survey does represent the true state of readiness in the industry. We understand that small practice providers and community hospitals will need a place to go to get answers to questions concerning clinical documentation needed to determine the correct and most appropriate diagnosis codes. While large institutions and provider practices may not need such assistance, the smaller practices, community practices will need assistance to determine if their current documentation practices will enable them to select the appropriate ICD-10 code. The work done, there was some work done earlier in the year by WEDI and MTMA and AADC to look at specialty practices and provide coding guides for those practices. I think that's an example of good quality material that can be disseminated. Finally, we recommend the subcommittee focus on the impact of the migration of ICD-10 on quality reporting and rating. ICD diagnosis codes are used by physicians, hospitals, and other healthcare providers to capture diagnosis for all patient encounters, as well as for health plan and provider quality measurements and reporting. Significant differences exist between ICD-9 and 10, and organizations such as National Committee for Quality Assurance, NCQA, have taken steps to support the transition. For example, NCQA has identified a set of ICD-10 codes for their HEDIS measures, which are used to assess commercial, Medicaid, Medicare Advantage health plan policies. One of the issues likely to arise with the transition to ICD-10 is the time required for providers to adjust the new coding system and submit claims with appropriate diagnosis codes that will capture denominator populations accurately comparable to those under ICD-10. It will be critical to monitor for any provider the coding trends or issues with data capture so that the appropriate action can be taken to ensure valid and reliable measurements. So in a synopsis, if you change the selection criteria for the denominator of a ratio that indicates some type of quality performance, you're going to shift the entire result. There's going to be discontinuity. It's important that we understand that at the quality measures level. So in closing, I want to reiterate that the health insurance industry's support for the implementation of ICD-10, which has numerous benefits. Health plans have extended significant resources to date in implementation, and it is critical that this momentum continues through October 1st. We recommend that CMS focus its efforts on reaching all providers and educating providers on proper coding. Finally, the subcommittee should closely monitor steps being taken to update quality measures and monitor the impact of ICD-10 on quality reporting and rating. I do appreciate your time and attention today. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Steve. Thanks. We have Rob next.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak on ICD-10, what we consider to be perhaps the most pressing challenge practices have faced in decades. What differentiates ICD-10 from, for example, EFT that was discussed this morning is that every link in the chain has to be ready. So if the provider software is not ready, it's okay, they can still get a pay for check. But with ICD-10, if any part of the link, if the payer, clearinghouse, vendor, provider, professional coder, if any of those aren't ready, then there's a problem. And when you ask yourself, well, why are providers so concerned about ICD-10? Why are they complaining so much? The implications of compliance, if they do it right, the implications are high costs and decreased productivity. That's the upside. The downside of this non-compliance is significant disruption in cash flow. I know Anas is going to talk about some costs, but this is the only HIPAA transition that I've gone through, and I've gone through them all, that we've seen the pushback from the providers to the extent that we have. And so I want to share with you some of our most recent research. We conducted it late in January. We got 570 practices where more than 21,000 physicians practice in more than 44 specialties. The average practice size was 8 physicians. And we asked the question, tell us if you're concerned or very concerned about various things, and you can see here 87% saying they're very concerned about the changes to clinical documentation. They're very concerned about clinician and coder productivity, and there's all kinds of anecdotes. There's a little bit of evidence floating around the industry suggesting it's an extra 5 minutes per clinical encounter. And you think, well, 5 minutes is not so bad, but if you're a primary care physician seeing 25 patients a day, that's a decrease in perhaps 20% of your patient load, which is equivalent to a 20% pay cut. So again, they're very, very concerned about the implications of ICD-10. They're also concerned about the various things that they'll have to do. For example, the patient encounter, the documentation to support that is going to change. Will it be more difficult? Well, about 90% say somewhat or much more difficult. The ability of the clinician and the coding staff to identify the right code, again, in the 90% plus range, and the ability to compare data is, of course, a very much a concern as well. In terms of cost, and people sort of throw figures around, but what we found with our survey is about 40% of vendors are offering their upgrade or replacement as part of the maintenance agreement. So of the rest of them, we asked, okay, assuming you're going to pay for it, what will be the cost that you will be expected to incur? So for the PM or the practice management system, per physician, the cost is $11,500, and for the EHR, almost $13,000. So you extrapolate that to a 10-physician practice, and that's almost $250,000 just for the software upgrades. But I think we've also seen some issues about lack of communication in the industry, and you can see here from our slide that communication flowing from the vendor to the providers is not happening as quickly as you want, and I think the WEDI survey collaborates this. Almost a quarter of practices report that they've not heard anything from their vendor, and here we are, as Walter said, 9, 8, 7 months, or somewhere in there away from compliance, and a very, very few vendors have actually reached out and made the upgrade. And again, the practice can't move forward with ICD-10 without that upgrade to the PM and the EHR. We've also found, and these numbers have gone up a little bit from our last survey in June, but still almost 60% of practices report that they've heard nothing from their health plans in terms of testing. And it's good to hear that Sid and others are moving ahead, but we've not heard of anybody who's actively testing now. So we're not that far away from the compliance date. And as you all know, the vast majority of claims from practices, especially smaller ones, are sent to health plans via clearinghouses. You can see here almost half are reporting that they've not heard anything from their clearinghouse regarding testing. So a few other critical industry issues, obviously, and it's been alluded to by Sid, payment policies are going to change, and it's great to hear that CMS is going to release some of their payment policies, but from a provider perspective, that's only one payer. And all of the payers are likely to change their payment policies. So very, very concerning. There's the myth of payment neutrality, and we'll see what happens after October 1st with that. I think a lot of us feel there's going to be winners and losers, and the losers are typically the smaller and rural-based practices. There's, again, another myth that using ICD-10 codes will result in fewer requests from health plans for additional documentation. There's no evidence at all to support that. We, in fact, believe the opposite, that if a specific code is entered and there's not the supporting documentation, it's very likely that they're going to be asked for more information before the claim is paid. We're also very concerned that we've been hearing, I won't steal any thunder from Tim, but I've talked to some clearinghouse personally that have indicated very, very few plans. Of 1,200 in their database, 40 had submitted their claim edits. And again, the clearinghouses need time to be able to incorporate those payment edits. They're the key link between the provider and the payer. If they're not ready, clearly there is going to be issues. And again, it reinforces why testing is absolutely critical, not just the front end, but also the end to end. It was very good to hear, John, that you've decided to change your policy on that. So what are we saying to our members? And we have all kinds of education out there, free webinars and guides. We certainly pointed them towards the thousands of documents that CMS has produced. But again, it's a chain. It's a process as well. So we're telling them staff buy-in. You've got to convince physicians that this is happening, that Matt is telling us the date's not moving, and we have to assume that. You've got to change, at least review your documentation. I think that's one of the key messages we're pushing out. Don't just allow your salesman to tell you your software is going to be ready. You've got to be aggressive. You've got to have it in writing, review your contracts, review your options. Focus on the codes and the payers that make up the vast majority of your payments. Ideal testing will be end-to-end, but any testing is better than no testing at all. Obviously, closely monitor your processing and reimbursement once the date comes. You have to assume there's going to be problems, and I say prepare for the what-ifs. What if your vendor's not ready? What if your professional coder retires? What happens if your clinicians aren't ready, your payer's not ready? The practice has to be assuming the worst and hoping for the best. Our recommendations, nothing surprising here. Good to hear the edits will be released at some point, maybe April. April 1st would be appropriate. Testing end-to-end, again, good to hear that you'll be doing some limited testing. You didn't give the number, but I assume it's five or more, I guess. I would suggest that as soon as you get any data back, and it would apply to SID in any pair, push it out to say, hey, here are the areas we're seeing concern with. Pay particular close attention to these areas. We'll talk about this afternoon, but clearly there's lots of non-covered entities out there in the industry that may or may not move to 10, and that's going to add, additional confusion to the industry. Work closely with all the vulnerable stakeholders. And I hate to bring up the dreaded C word, but contingency has to be put on the table. We've not gone through any HIPAA transaction identifier change without having a contingency period. That's just the reality of it. So we have to assume there's going to be one. Let's get started on it. Let's work as an industry to say, okay, this is going to work, this is not going to work. Not that we want to slow down process, the progress, but the reality is there's going to be problems. So what can we do to mitigate them? And again, if there's a problem with EFT, we fall back to paper. If there's a problem with claims and we're not paid, the door's closed. So it's not the same level. You want to be looking at relaxed edits, dual use of codes, albeit it's going to be a challenge for the plans. Advanced payments to providers, especially those in the more vulnerable practices. And I hate to say it, but potentially looking at extensions. If things are not looking good, we're going to continue to monitor our guys. Strongly encourage you, Robert, to push out as many surveys as possible. If things are looking like we're moving towards a cliff, then we have to reevaluate. So, thanks.
Thank you. Thank you, Rob. We're going to go quickly to Nancy, I think. Nancy.
Okay, thank you, and on behalf of the Physician and Medical Student members of the American Medical Association, thank you for inviting us here today to provide our input on IC-10 implementation transition. Our testimony on this topic is going to focus on three recent activities by us, and the first is the study that we commissioned by Nockamson Advisors to update the estimated cost of implementing IC-10. The second is a survey that we had done in January asking physicians on the status of their IC-10 software upgrades by their vendors. And the final is a letter that we sent last week to Secretary Sebelius expressing our ongoing concerns with ICD-10. As background, many of you are aware that AMA has long recognized that the transition to IC-10 for physicians is a massive unfunded mandate that is not expected to improve the care physicians provide to their patients. The work on IC-10 also comes at a time of unprecedented number of overlapping requirements that physicians must meet, including the EHR Meaningful Use Program, e-prescribing, physician quality reporting system requirements. All of these are competing for the practice's time, staff, and resources. I'm going to start first with talking about the Nachumson Advisor report that came out last week. In 2008, Nachumson Advisors had done a study estimating cost for IC-10 implementation. And at that time, it was all just estimates. There was no real-world information about actual cost. And so this 2014 study is using updated data, costs, real-world examples, and provides much more up-to-date information around the cost. And you can see here in the table what those costs were estimated to be in 2008 versus the range of costs that were provided in the study. So you can see that. And you can see at the high end of the range, in some cases, nearly three times, the costs are going to be nearly three times what was predicted in 2008. And the study does break out the estimated cost based on these different categories. So it's looking at training, assessments, vendor software upgrades, process remediation, testing, productivity loss, payment disruption. So it's pretty comprehensive in terms of looking at all of the impacts cost-wise on a practice. The conclusion is that we view IC-10 as being financially disastrous for physicians. And for those of you who are interested in looking at the full report, this is the website. It's available on our website. And I did provide that as support materials for the subcommittee. So the second activity we did in January was to do a quick, very short survey of physician practices on the status of their IC-10 software upgrades. And what we found in that, actually not as good of data as what Rob just talked about in their survey, but we are seeing that fewer than half, so around 47% of practices responded that they are aware that their vendor plans to upgrade their software for IC-10. So that means that you can see there 40% don't know. And that, to us, indicates that there's just not good communication happening between the practices and the vendors, and that's a pretty high number at this point in time. And then looking at when those expected upgrades will happen, 5% reported that they did receive those before January 1, 26% expect to receive those upgrades before April, and then you can see the numbers trail off after that. What's really concerning out of this to us is that nearly one-third do not know at all when their upgrades are going to happen. And while the results of the survey, as limited as they are, that it does leave us questioning just how ready the vendor industry is for IC-10. And without these system upgrades in place in the practices, they're going to be unable to test their systems both internally and externally with their trading partners. And this, of course, puts them at a greater risk for disruptions in claims processing once the deadline comes. So the other piece that I want to talk about is the letter that we had sent to Secretary Sebelius last week and concerns that we outlined in that letter. So one of the first concerns is something we've been talking about, which is testing. And we are very concerned about the lack of industry-wide true end-to-end testing, and we're very encouraged by the recent announcement this morning, just now, that CMS is going to look at doing some end-to-end testing in a small sample, essentially, of providers, and that is something that we had specifically put into our letter, that as an option that we would like to see happen. Another activity that has us encouraged is we saw that Senator Coburn sent a letter yesterday to CMS asking very pointed, very specific questions about what testing will be and what the results of that testing will look like and how that will relate to the industry's readiness. So, again, we believe that end-to-end testing is essential for ensuring that physicians will not suffer the massive disruptions in claims and payment processing, and ultimately risking physicians' ability to care for their patients. The other concern that we have, again, goes into the disruption of payments, and we're very concerned about payments and payment flowing, and we're concerned that Medicare is not seeking to be more flexible in their advance payment policy, which would address those situations where there's cash flow interruptions. And we just want to point out that this was a recommendation that NCVHS had made to CMS in a letter dated September 11, 2011, and that language is there. In terms of coding requirements, we're concerned that payers are going to put strict requirements on the specificity of codes reported and reject or pend claims and further compound payment disruptions. And that is something that Rob was just talking about a little bit, too, in terms of attachments and asking for more information. Those are concerns that we have. And finally, we feel that IC-10 is part of a mix right now that is just impeding progress towards other requirements that physicians are being asked to do. So right now we've got stage two meaningful use that's coming on board. Physicians need to have their 2014 certified EHRs in place, and that's requiring a software upgrade. The patch for IC-10 in many cases is going to be installed separately by the vendors. Again, we're hearing for the timing of the EHR upgrades, we have concerns that that the practices aren't going to have enough time to have everything installed and test before the compliance deadline. And also, physicians who are starting meaningful use in 2014 have until September 30th to attest. And we just feel there are so many moving parts going on right now and potential for collisions between meaningful use and IC-10. And it's also impeding the ability for physicians to purchase technology and participate in new payment and delivery reform models that can improve care coordination and reduce costs. Those are the things that they're unable to do because of this IC-10 requirement. So in conclusion, we just have the following points which address the questions that were asked. Again, the cost studies were very concerned about IC-10's cost and it being far higher than what was initially estimated. What we're seeing is that software upgrades by vendors are behind schedule. We don't have specific data on testing at this point, but we have strong doubts about what kind of testing is happening since we only saw that 5% of practices have gotten their software upgrades as of January 1. We do see that testing is a major priority and ask that that be true end-to-end testing, and we're, again, happy to hear what Medicare is announcing. And, again, we just, all of these points raise serious doubts about the industry's readiness and ability to meet the deadline, and we strongly urge CMS to reconsider the mandate. So thank you again for inviting us to testify.
Thanks, Nancy. Let's move to George.
All right, good morning, everyone, and distinguished members of the National Committee on Vital and Health Statistics. I want to thank you on behalf of the American Hospital Association, its 5,000 member hospitals, health systems, and other healthcare organizations, and our 43,000 individual members for the opportunity to testify today regarding the transition to ICD-10. My remarks will speak really to three topics, hospital readiness for ICD-10, the extensive investments already made to prepare for ICD-10, and the importance of end-to-end testing to ensure a successful transition. In terms of readiness for ICD-10, the AHA has always supported the statutory requirement that we transition to ICD-10 because it provides modernization of coding and billing systems. While it entails significant effort and cost, the move to ICD-10 is important to ensure payment accuracy and build our understanding of healthcare delivery. ICD-9 has simply run out of room and likely does not provide sufficient detail on patient severity to support advanced payment models. In order to achieve the successful transition to ICD-10, the entire healthcare community, hospitals, physicians, payers, clearinghouses, and government agencies must stop debating ICD-10 and take the needed actions to achieve successful implementation. Based on preliminary data from an AHA survey that concluded last week, we found that the vast majority of hospitals are confident that they will be ready to transition to ICD-10 by October 1st, the implementation date. Most are actively training coders, educating physicians, and either beginning or planning for testing with payers. When asked about risk to timely transition, hospitals most commonly cited lack of external testing with Medicare and other payers. They are also concerned about the competing priority of meaningful use. Indeed, the AHA and other provider organizations have requested that CMS extend the meaningful use timelines for 2014, in part to allow hospitals and physicians to focus on ICD-10. Hospitals, physicians, and physicians have had significant advance warning of the transition date for ICD-10. Hospitals have been preparing for ICD-10 for 3 years with the understanding that it will be a challenge, but it will need to be accomplished, and that it can be accomplished if all parties work together. It is true that under ICD-10, the coding system will significantly grow. However, the expansion is based on reasons such as the identification of laterality, left, right, bilateral, creation of combination codes, and identification of chronology of encounters for injuries, such as initial, subsequent, or the call. Although the code set is large, any physician practice would use only a small subset that is relevant to the services it delivers. And specialty societies have developed many tools to facilitate the transition, such as developing top 50 lists by specialty. In addition, the super bill updated to ICD-10 will continue to be a crucial tool for physician offices and will aid them in learning the segment of ICD-10 relevant to their work. Investments already made to prepare. Clearly, hospitals have invested significant financial and staff resources in preparing for the October 1st, 2014 transition date on the understanding that this date was firm. Specifically, hospitals are actively training coding staff, educating physicians about ICD-10, coding concepts, and the importance of improving documentation. Finalizing information system changes that they have already worked with vendors to implement. They're conducting financial impact assessments and completing internal testing and contacting payers, clearinghouses, and other trading partners to schedule testing. Hospitals do not want to see the large investments that they have already made to prepare for ICD-10 wasted. Hospitals' proactive approach to ICD-10 preparation should be recognized and serve as an example to others, including Medicare. The importance of end-to-end testing. To this end, last November, the AHA sent a letter to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services urging the agency to expedite its ICD-10 testing plans to ensure testing begins no later than January 2014 and be made available to all hospitals. Extensive end-to-end testing by Medicare contractors and state Medicaid agencies for both the electronic transaction and the adjudication of the claim is crucial to ensure a smooth transition from ICD-9 to ICD-10. Indeed, the implementation timelines on CMS's own ICD-10 webpage show that testing for hospitals should have started in October 2013 and continue through this summer. Therefore, we are very concerned about a recent CMS notice that identified only 1 week in March for ICD-10 testing. Although we're encouraged to hear that testing has been expanded. Testing only 1 week in March is not adequate. The AHA urged CMS to expedite the testing process to begin as soon as possible and ensure all testing is complete by the end of June so that providers, payers, and clearinghouses can resolve any issues discovered during the testing and complete training well in advance of the October 1st transition date. In my written testimony, you will see a graphic of the steps that we believe are needed for adequate testing. While the graphic is specific to Medicare, it also applies to private payers and Medicaid. The graphic illustrates two key components that should be part of ICD-10 testing, testing for connectivity and for content. The initial testing approach that many hospitals are using consists of selecting a representative sample of previously paid claims and recoding them to ICD-10. If the claim passes a front-end edit, it is then ready for the content evaluation. In this step, the health plan will typically examine the diagnosis and procedure codes along with the pertinent information on the claim to determine how it would adjudicate the claim for payment purposes. For inpatient hospital claims that are paid under a diagnosis-related group, payment would be based on the DRG assigned using ICD-10 codes. hospitals should be able to compare the DRG assigned using ICD-10 to the DRG assignment on the original claim. If the two DRG assignments are consistent, then the hospital can feel confident that the coders have appropriately interpreted the medical record and used the right ICD-10 code. If not, the hospital must investigate the cause of the discrepancy. To ensure a successful transition between now and the end of June, the focus must be on testing both connectivity and content of claims using ICD-10 codes. The lessons learned from this testing period will allow providers and health plans the opportunity to evaluate whether additional adjustments or improvements are needed, and it would give them enough time to make any necessary adjustments. Medicare and other payers must also develop and share their contingency plans for those providers who have difficulty in the transition period. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to participate in today's discussion.
Thank you, George. We'll move quickly to Meryl.
Good morning, or afternoon almost, I guess, or it is. Thank you. I don't have time. Thanks. My name is Meryl Bloomrosen. I'm the Vice President of Thought Leadership, Practice Excellence, and Public Policy for the American Health Information Management Association, or AHIMA, and I am delighted to be here on behalf of our 71,000 members to address the issues before the subcommittee. For those of you that may not be familiar with AHIMA, I'd just like to say a few words. We've been around since 1928 and have been the premier association of professionals, educated, trained, certified, and working in the field of health information management and health informatics. AHIMA has often been recognized as a leading source of HIM knowledge, a leader in assuring that health information is valid, accurate, complete, trustworthy, and timely, and we are a respected authority for rigorous professional education and training. And I would like to thank you all for inviting us to provide some information. And Denicia, I'd like to make sure that our acronym can go on your slide. And we offer our 72,000 members and our component state and local associations to assist you with nationwide training for all providers, particularly the small physician practices that you mentioned. So I'd like to follow up with you on behalf of AHIMA and see what we can do to assist in that regard. I would also offer our expertise and our members' collective abilities to help with Medicaid implementations as well. We have component state associations throughout the country, primarily one in each state or territory, and then there are local and regional associations, and we'd be delighted to help you. AHIMA and our members have been involved in many aspects of coding, classification, terminology, and standards and systems for decades. Many of us, including myself personally, have actually lived through the implementation and transition from 8 to 9, although the issues on the table back then were not as significant or as profound and I guess as complicated as they are today. But those of us who were around back then can testify that it can be done. And we do have some scars and bruises probably to show for it, but we're here still pushing the ball down the court and in support of the implementation of ICD-10 on October 1st of 2014. I'd also like to mention that since the 1960s, AHIMA has been a proud member of the cooperating parties for the United States for the use of ICD in classification, along with the AHA, the CDC, and CMS, and we do serve on the editorial boards for ICD-9, ICD-10, HCPCS, PCS, and CPT. And AHIMA happens to also be the designated secretariat for ISO 215 Health Informatics and the administrator for the U.S. TAS. I don't want to repeat some of the findings and issues and challenges that have already been mentioned by the previous panelists. Obviously, we're pressed for time this afternoon, but given that we all have so much to say about this important topic, I would like to emphasize a couple of things on behalf of our members, and that is that we recognize that the cost of ICD-10 implementation, especially for the smaller physician practices, has been raised as a significant challenge, and we would echo the comments that the previous panelists have said and suggest strongly that CMS and applaud CMS
for your announcements earlier today about the training that you're making available, the resources that you're making available, and the end-to-end testing that you have described. There have been lots of studies that have been alluded to. We cite several of them in our written testimony, and we would just offer an observation that in terms of all of the various studies that have been done and those that are still planned, I'm not sure that there's agreement on what the word readiness means in terms of getting ready for ICD-10. I think there's a gut feeling that we'll know it when we see it, but we would just caution that there's probably gradations in terms of readiness as well as the ability for practices and providers to be ready. And we support provider, payer, and clearinghouse activities to that end. There's a couple of risks that we've identified on behalf of our members and the folks that they serve, and some of them have already been mentioned. We do want to emphasize, and I'd like to emphasize today, that we believe of all these risks, many of them can be mitigated, not eliminated, but mitigated through thorough training and education, advanced planning and preparation. And we, I'm here to again reinforce some of the activities that AHIMA and its members have been doing and our willingness to work side by side with the industry stakeholders to assure that these efforts continue. Significant implementation challenges have been identified by our members and by numbers of stakeholders around the table, and those also relate to coder education, clinician education, workforce shortages, and clinical documentation improvement. Ensuring high-quality, comprehensive ICD-10 education is critical to assuring coding accuracy and lessening the expected productivity of coders and clinicians. We have observed during our ICD-10 training programs that coders and others involved in the coding process are in general embracing the need to go forward with ICD-10 implementation and are trying their very best to prepare themselves on behalf of the folks they work with to develop and enhance their coding skills to be able to code using ICD-10 in advance of the October 1st implementation date. Clinical documentation improvement is, in fact, something that others have mentioned this morning that is seen as a major challenge in the ICD-10 transition, and AHIMA stands ready and offers training and support to help transition to better coding clinical documentation improvement. I'd like to mention some data on coder training. Since July of 2009, AHIMA has conducted extensive ICD-10 academies for over 8,500 participants. These academies train individuals who self-identified that they wanted to provide coding training to others, a term called kind of like train the trainer concept. And according to our records, in addition to the participants of these academies, we currently have more than 6,000 active AHIMA-approved ICD-10 trainers, and that is a designation earned upon successful completion of our academy as well as a proficiency exam. Since 2010, we have also been working with a diverse array of healthcare organizations and payers, and we've been providing private ICD-10 training, either in the form of train-the-trainer training or coder workforce training. And many of these individuals who have completed the train-the-trainer coding have gone on to train others in ICD-10 coding. Again, as I mentioned earlier, we'd be pleased to work with CMS and other payers to see how these types of training academies could be leveraged to assure that others who need to be trained or want to be trained, that can be done in time for ICD-10 implementation. There are lots of comments that we could make about computer-assisted coding and clinical documentation improvement. Those you could find in my written testimony. We would also urge CMS to consider those types of tools and resources. I'm not totally sure, and I apologize for not knowing to what extent we could co-link to each other's websites, but we'd like to make available the resources that we've got to the members that might come up on your website.
We agree that communicating with non-covered entities is an issue, and we urge that healthcare providers discuss ICD-10 transition plans with non-covered entities with whom they do business. We do have a resource entitled Universal Use of ICD-10 CMPCS in the U.S. to assist in communicating the value to non-covered entities to transition to ICD-10, and we'd be pleased to make that available. We agree and acknowledge that planning for sufficient testing with external partners prior to the compliance date is essential for achieving a smooth and successful nationwide transition, and we believe and agree with the issues related to whether or not or to what extent vendors are in fact ready, and we urge CMS to urge the vendor community to become as ready as they can be in as quickly a time period as possible. To summarize and to be mindful of the time, it's a red light I'm seeing in front of me, AHIMA is committed to helping the healthcare industry successfully transition to ICD-10 on October 1st, 2014. In addition to the training I mentioned earlier, we have produced a wide range of resources to assist with this transition and implementation, and we'd be pleased to make them available not just to the HIM community, but to other sectors within the industry. We would mention, we'd like to mention, and Rob, maybe you're aware of this, that we've actually had several of our members help produce training videos for CMS. I think they're available on YouTube and elsewhere, and we're delighted to have had that opportunity, and we look forward to working with the stakeholders to further this endeavor. Thank you.
Thank you, Mel. Thank you very much. Jill?
Yes. Hello. I'll just briefly introduce myself, since many of you do not know who I am. I am representing PACOM today, Professional Association of Healthcare Office Management. I am on the National Advisory Board for 4 years now. I've also worked with local chapter for 11 years. We meet with managers monthly, and I'm a practice manager who's in the trenches right now for small office practices. I've been in the healthcare industry for 26 years. So to begin, I'm very appreciative for the invitation to participate in this hearing. And I do have a few slides. Let me... Thank you so much. Apologize. PACOM represents small physician office practices all across all specialties. Thousands of solo and 2 to 10 physician group practices still exist across the country. It is essential to get buy-in by these physicians who still own small practices and who play different roles. Some physicians want to take the lead and be involved in the entire process, and some not. It's important for providers and managers to be in sync. Practice managers continue to play an integral role in facilitating full office transition and compliance. I apologize. PACOM did participate in CMS ICD-10 Readiness Assessment Survey with respondents representing small practices from across the country. These are just a few of the states I had listed on that slide. There were varying levels of awareness. Nearly 100% of small practices are aware of the ICD-10 requirements. Only 0.8% admitted to being unaware. However, there is varying levels of awareness and familiarity with these requirements. Only 23% said they were very aware and very familiar. When polled, a concerning number of respondents report unknown expected dates due to begin external testing, 31.3%. Small practices are still dependent, as previously mentioned, still dependent on their vendors. There is a disconnect between vendors and the practice. Survey reveals moderate confidence within the industry, recommends improved confidence in small practice industry through reaffirmation, continue the massive education, outreach, and guidance, provide a feeling of hand-holding before, during, and after the implementation. Online training continues to prove invaluable. A startling number of practices admit to not starting key implementation processes, but training and billing updates, software, things like that. Websites, implementation guides, and online training continue to prove to be valuable resources for offices. Fact sheets and face-to-face training were also very high. As you just mentioned, training videos are fantastic. The Paycom YouTube channel contains many detailed ICD-10 training videos. We hope to gain some more. One of the videos on there has received over 7,000 views. Some of the other videos posted are already up to 4,000 views. Continued resources. We also send e-note blasts with latest updates. That's how the survey link was distributed. It's fantastic once you get to the end of that, that you're then connected to more CMS resources. Paycom.com offers CMS resource page, providing additional ways to navigate to CMS. Small practice guides. This is considered a go-to place for small practice management guidance. It's non-intimidating. It directs you to starting places on the CMS site. Then most will continue to navigate on their own once that they are there. Additionally, practices are asking for live person to call with questions and for troubleshooting support. Yes, live support is a dying breed, but still requested whenever they're faced with uncertainties. I agree, automation is more efficient and personally like the online chat options. Additionally, practices are asking for assistance with vendor readiness and upgrades, in-house chart audit guides, more on-demand webinars, additional training tools for physician documentation. I'll get it right one of these times here. There we go. Concerns remain among small office physician practices for funding ICD training and transition. Still concerns for disruptions in the business of delivering care, cost of software upgrades, lack of provider time to train and educate, and loss of productivity during that time, physicians' resistance and physicians' understanding. Yes, there's so many moving parts. There's concerns for claims rejections and denials, insufficient time to implement, along with meaningful use, PQRS, patient-centered medical homes, ACA. There's a feeling of no more absorption in this sponge of change. There's a fear of insurance company readiness. Additional suggestions. For assisting small physician office practices, additional website resources and training videos presented in different ways to appeal to all the different learning styles, offer at different levels of implementation. CMS trainers dispatched to Paycom chapters focusing training on both the physicians and the managers. It'll not only offer a finger on the pulse of progress, but it'll also send a message to the message of we're here to help. CMS presenter at national conferences, ours is in October, provide troubleshooting guidance. I think that panic may set in for those who thought that they were ready but find that they were not. The plan to be there for guidance, reassurance, and post-implementation issues. Facilitate vendor and provider communications. Small practices are highly dependent on the vendors. Talks are just now beginning about expected system changes, et cetera, in these small practices. Maybe allow a grace period for submission of ICD-9 and ICD-10 by providers to allow real-time trial and error. If a claim is denied under ICD-10, then allow resubmission under ICD-9 and allow practice time to figure out where their problems lie. Maybe a soft go-live date or a progressive format, 20% of claims and 50%, things like that. So I thank you for allowing me to contribute some comments.
Thank you, Jill. Thank you very much. Debbie?
Good afternoon. I'm Debbie Meisner with MDON. Know many of you, so I won't go into who MDON is. I think most of you are familiar with us, other than to say that entering 2014, MDON is now processing over 7 billion healthcare transactions each year. And so we have a broad reach to over 700,000 physicians, 81,000 dentists, pharmacies, 5,000 hospitals, et cetera. So we do have a very broad reach in the industry. All right. So there we go. Oh, am I doing a... So this is just to give you a perspective on who we're reaching in our communication and how we're handling things. Today I want to focus on our remediation efforts, the challenges that we've face as well as our customers, some of the strategies for helping our customers through this transition, our testing approach, and key messages to our customers. One of the things I do want to point out as I'm going through this is I'm going to try to be clear, because I think there has been some confusion in discussions, when I'm speaking from the clearinghouse perspective versus MDON's products. And I think those of us in this clearinghouse industry all have our products that help us support things that are at the hands of the physicians versus the clearinghouse. So I'm going to try to make sure I'm clear
in discussing which ones I'm talking about. So at the clearinghouse or MDON exchange, we are fully remediated. We did this as part of our 5010 migration. We made sure all of our internal processes were ready. And our product that we use, or several of our products, will be fully remediated by the end of Q1 of this year. We have worked directly with our channel partners, who are the vendors that sit in front of us, and our payers to provide education on what we're doing. We have a HIPAA website that we call the HIPAAsimplified.com, which is very actively hit by the industry as a whole. And we have on that website our playbook. We put that out very early in the process and made sure that our customers were aware of it. We published this in October of 2012 that clearly stated what ICD-10 was and what the expectations would be. So in an effort to gauge the readiness of our customers, MDON does analytics on the transaction formats that are exchanged with our trading partners. I know there is some concern of clearinghouses taking proprietary formats and will they be ICD-10 ready. At this point in time, what we are finding is 96.78% of all of the volume coming into the clearinghouse for professional claims is in a 5010 format. There still remains 3.2% that are in legacy formats, either 4010 or NSF or paper print image or proprietary formats still coming in. On the hospital side, we're seeing 99.76% that have moved to a 5010 format and 0.24% that still remain on legacy formats coming into the clearinghouse. It's important to note that although these transactions are coming in the 5010 format, that can accommodate ICD-10. It doesn't necessarily mean that the applications that feed into the 5010 have been remediated. So the practice management system still may be feeding ICD-9, which 5010 is capable of carrying. So we need to make sure that there isn't a false sense of security that people are moving to 5010. However, we're very encouraged that this number is where it is right now. This does present a challenge to us in determining what the actual readiness is of providers, since ICD-10 is going to be a big bang point in time, unlike other transactions where we've been able to help you folks with what's going on. Some of the challenges we're seeing, you've heard about, I'm not going to belabor them. They are dependent on their common systems to be delivered to accommodate test data. There is an expectation that payers are going to provide accurate payment outcomes during testing. So there is that expectation that may or may not be there. And again, and we'll hear later this afternoon, the non-covered entities are also a challenge. Our strategies, we are actively involved in our outreach and education. We work very closely with the SDOs, and we were involved with the CMS N10 testing model. We are positioned to participate in the CMS testing week, and we've been announcing this, so I was a little concerned to hear that providers aren't getting this information. It's my understanding that since December, we've been putting this out on a weekly basis, telling our providers, come, we're ready. Our approach to this is going to be, this is an asynchronous implementation. The providers are reliant on their software getting delivered, and they're not going to know when the payers are ready. So we've provided a portal for them to come in, deliver your claims to us. We'll look at it, make sure it is format correct, and that you are providing ICD-10 codes correctly, and we will give the providers the clearinghouse feedback. And when the payers are ready, we're going to store those claims. When payers are ready, we have an automated process called On24x7, where the payers can come in and pick up any claims that have been natively coded on their behalf. So providers can send us all their claims. If you think of a clearinghouse, we're getting claims for all of our our payers on the backside. And so these can be stored, and when the payers are ready, they can come and pick it up. Unfortunately, the challenge that we're facing is, although we have made this announcement in December that we would be participating in CMS's program, and please send your claims now, don't wait for that week. We can store them and be ready to give them to the MACs during the week of testing. We have to date received 4 claims. And this is alarming to us. And we have been continually sending this information out to the providers to let them know. So I've talked about this, the approach that we're taking, it's unlimited volume. They can send as many claims into us as they want, whenever they want. what we are finding is payers are going to be limiting, so we can they can come in and take however many claims they can handle in their test portal that has been designated for them. We did participate in a pilot test with one of our large payers, and we are engaged ongoing with our account managers, working directly with the larger payers, making sure that we all have our milestones and that we're ready and all singing the same song. Our product is going to be ready to begin testing through this test portal that we've got set up, this automated system. And we also, in the Claim Master, so I've heard this, we're going to be providing feedback to the providers, letting them know what their top rejections are around their testing. And in addition, we have created in that product a tool that will help them that they can customize for their own. So to the point of where some of the specialties have lists of here's your critical codes to be testing for in your specialty, they can customize their pop-up screen to do their ICD-10 coding based on their business practice. So the tool that sits at the provider desk is going to allow that type of education for them. Our key messages is that we believe, and so this is where the product versus a clearinghouse, we believe that a clearinghouse cannot upcode or downcode for the providers. It's critical to have the medical records to make sure that you're collecting the appropriate code. That does not mean it's not appropriate to upcode or downcode at the desktop where the providers have control of it, where they have the clinical information. But as the clearinghouse part of our business, we believe that we should not be doing that. And we've been pretty vocal with that. Not all of our trading partners are going to be ready, and people need to understand that. As much as we want, it's important for us to have these contingency plans and communicate what is your contingency plan if on October 1st you install your ICD-10 programs and something doesn't work. What is your backup plan? And make sure that your trading partners, your clearinghouses, and your direct providers understand what your backup plan is going to be. And providers, make sure you're communicating to your trading partners if on August 31st or September 1st you still have not received your software, what is the backup plan for you? Do you know how you're going to get claims to your payers and how they're going to get paid? I've been doing this for 40-some-odd years. I hate to say that, but I have never seen anything get implemented without a little bit of a glitch somewhere. So always make sure that we have contingency plans, and what are they? That's a big communication that we're going out there. And we ask that lessons be shared as people test this. What did you find out? Were there some codes that caused more problems than others? We've yet really seen any good communication on how things are really going with what you're doing. And so that we're concerned that the testing that we're doing may provide a false sense of security, so we are also encouraging our providers to make sure that they keep track of what's going on after the implementation compliance date. How are things going? Did you see an impact to your cash flow? What was wrong? What do you need to adjust? Don't just put it in there and think, okay, everything went well, nothing blew up, everything's working great. They do need to monitor, and this is a message we're clearly giving to our providers. So I thank you, and we'd be glad to take any questions.
Thanks. Tim, please.
Thank you, Walter. Well, good afternoon, everyone. My name is Tim McMullen, Executive Director of the Cooperative Exchange, which is a recognized resource and representative of the clearinghouse industry, and we are committed to promote advanced electronic data interchange in the healthcare industry by improving efficiency, advocacy, education, and for industry stakeholders and government entities. And on behalf of all of our 30 million clearinghouse members. Well, everybody else was throwing a number out, so I thought, well, along the lines of helping with education and advocacy, I wanted to let
everyone know that to help facilitate ICD-10 testing during the remaining transition period, the cooperative exchange will gather information on payers regarding their testing parameters. There's been an industry concern about the lack of knowledge on what to expect in testing from payers, and this will be a public one-stop resource on the cooperative exchange website. We actually spoke to Denisha Green about that yesterday, and they've been willing to help on that. And speaking of that, I wanted to publicly acknowledge how wonderful Denisha has been in making herself quite available to us and others and really being a great voice for CMS. You know, there still are a number of issues that CMS, commercial payers, vendors, and providers must focus on before the compliance date. Overall, you know, we feel that the due diligence for ICD-10 implementation and readiness of all training partners for in-depth testing are still the cornerstones of our concern. For CMS, during 5010, it was clear that the MACs were affected by system updates for their front-end systems, and that their due diligence and preparation internal testing of updates selected beta partner testing was not conducted prior to release of the software updates and go live. So as Debbie was saying, the testing gave us all a false sense of security. When actual production came into account, it was a disaster. But we did share some of our concerns with Denisha yesterday about CMS, and some of those were the technical and operational remediation and readiness, the DRG shift analysis, especially in the high-risk categories, the shifts in problemic code identification completion, testing and remediation of systems and processing, identification of impacts of the DRG Groupers Vision 31 product updates still outstanding, the status of those product updates, the readiness of external testing in depth. Again, we're happy to hear today about the end-to-end testing. And another concern of ours that we saw in 5010 was the addition of personnel and the need for a lot more folks, telephone lines, and so forth to be able to help whenever those issues occur. And have the communication plans internally and externally been enhanced to ensure all personnel and customers are notified of any changes, problems, issues, and et cetera. And, you know, to echo what Debbie was saying about contingency plans, at ASCX 12, we held a clearinghouse caucus. One of the interesting, just somebody mentioned this, I don't even know who it was, but they said, does CMS have a contingency plan if things go horribly wrong on their end? So I don't know. We also have concern, of course, with commercial payers. Large payers have been working on their initiatives for 2 to 3 years, as we heard about the hospitals. But, of course, there are the smaller payers. How are they getting along? Are they doing their due diligence? Commercial payers differ in their business modes, number of types of lines of business, and with the complexity of the integration of ICD-10, payer systems are very complex and accommodate many lines of business. So it's really extremely difficult to identify and run every scenario during testing because there's just so many lines of business out there. Again, with the commercial payers, remediation have approaches and complexities been identified to include shifts in systems and workflow. And again, with commercial payers, the same thing about ramping up your call centers. Are they doing a job of opening up new phone lines and things like that? When have their test plans, have their test plans been published? And, of course, this database I was talking about, if you go to the website and check, we'll have payer testing plans. When are they going to be the release edits? That also will be on our website. And have their communication plans internally and externally been enhanced to ensure all personnel and customers are notified of changes, problems, et cetera. Vendors. Well, we heard from Rob about the vendors getting ready and others. Their software releases. Most of them say that in the spring and the summer. Well, that's going to cause a bottleneck of testing. That's just going to be a nightmare for clearinghouses when everybody knocks on our door on September 1st and says, hey, we're ready to test, along with 60,000 other providers. And getting to the providers, it was an interesting point that Rob made about a lot of providers haven't heard from the clearinghouses of what's going on. And I guess maybe we're not doing our due diligence of going back to the providers and say, we don't have anything to tell you because the payers aren't telling us anything. But providers are upgrading as many as 1 to 4 44,000 software programs in their organizations to accommodate ICD-10. And, you know, with that many platforms, there's a million points of potential failure. So providers must understand that their due diligence is identification of all those points of failure. So, again, like everybody else, we're very concerned about the provider readiness. But talking about the provider readiness, and Jill, I definitely want to get your card, because Weedy and the CE are going to be giving a webinar on Friday where on sort of giving providers an opportunity on how to prepare for ICD-10. One quick thing that we're offering as a suggestion is claim tracking identification. And a claim tracking ID would create a true benefit to all EDI stakeholders. This tracking ID would be assigned to the primary payer for each transaction within the claim batch, and the claim is then sent to a secondary payer like Medicaid. That same tracking ID continues to follow the transaction throughout the life cycle of the transaction. It's written in the 837 as a submitter loop. It stamps the claim similar to the ICN number assigned to a Medicare plan. So that is coming from the clearinghouse standpoint. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Tim. Thank you. All right. So, as I said at the beginning, our subcommittee is not well known for keeping the time. So we are, of course, way over our allocated time for the session. What we want to do is we're going to give you a full 40 minutes for lunch. And we'll come back at 1:30 if you all can. So that probably means 35 minutes. We're going to adjust a little bit of the time right after lunch. We'll invite you all to please sit on your spots, and we'll have at least a good 40-minute discussion. And from that point on, we're going to adjust the schedule for the remaining of the day. But we do want to have at least a good 40 minutes for questions. We have a number of questions from different members. So thank you again for the testimony, and we look forward to the discussion right after lunch, and we look forward to seeing you all at 1:30 back here. Thank you. We're going to try to go ahead and start so people can take their seats. So thank you so much again for the testimony on ICD-10. First, I want to acknowledge a couple of new people that have joined us, and I know there's a person that is new to the panel, so... Larry, do you want to introduce yourself?
I'm Larry Green. I'm a member of the full committee. I have no conflict.
Thank you. And do we have anybody else that have joined on the phone that have not introduced themselves yet? Nobody? Okay. And Mary, do you want to...
Hi, Mari Sivikas, AMA. I'm sitting in for Nancy. She's caught the stomach flu, so we sent her home.
I don't think it was ICD-10.
It was totally ICD-10, and I'm going to need a diagnosis code.
I was just going to say, give us the diagnosis code. What did you do? I'm going to look it up. What did she do?
All right, so what we wanted to do was have a few Q&A with the subcommittee on this many issues. I think this particular panel gave an opportunity to show off a picture of generally where things are with respect to the transition process and what are some of the priorities that we have ahead. I guess I'll start with just a general question to the group, and I know I had a question also online from one of our members of the subcommittee, which I'll pose as well. So my question is probably one that everybody has in mind, and some comments have led to that. But what are the plans really to do, or how our organization is going to handle the reality that is going to happen October 1st when people have to use ICD-10, but they're not going to be ready, not all of them, and so they're going to still be exchanging transactions, even though it's not going to be compliant sending transactions with ICD-9 codes. The actions or the approaches that are going to be taken by organizations. I heard a couple, you know, there's certainly the expectation that a dual system is going to have to be in place for a few months, maybe several months after the deadline. What are the actions and really approaches that organizations have in mind with respect to certainly what seems to be a reality that's going to happen after October 1st? So we'll start with Debbie.
From a provider perspective, our provider products, they already realize they're going to have to support both 9 and 10 to do workers' comp and non-covered entities and run-out claims. So their contingency is to be able to continue to code 9 if they need to. From the clearinghouse perspective, what we've made clear to our customers is our contingency plan is to execute your contingency plan. So as a payer, you need to communicate to us if you've got a glitch and you need us to continue, or for some reason you've communicated with your providers and you're worried about the rejection rate that you're going to get. If you say, don't turn the edits on, continue to send us 9, that's what we'll do. If you say, turn my edits on for October 1st and reject claims if they come in with a 10 code, then that's what we'll do. So we feel our role as a clearinghouse is to execute the contingency plans of our customers. And we can't do anything else. We certainly can't up or down code without clinical information. We have set up our clearinghouse edits to be able to be configured and turned on and off. You know, if midway through the first week the payers are saying they're rejecting, you know, a large percentage of their customers, their provider customers, and they don't want to do that, then they can just tell us to shut the edit off or turn the edit on, whichever way they want to go. So that's our contingency plan.
Okay. Yeah.
Just a thought, maybe for point of clarification, it seems to me that regardless of whether people are compliant or non-compliant or ready or not ready, there's going to be a time period where ICD-9 and ICD-10 are going to overlap for some period of time just based on claims adjudication and coding processes and doctors and other providers, completion of clinical documentation. So there's probably some time period. I don't know what it is. It may vary by provider, and since I'm not representing providers, I wouldn't want to speak on their behalf. But I would think we might want, as an industry, to think through how to help providers understand that, yeah, the switch may turn on or off on October 1, but nevertheless, there's going to be dual coding going on for a period of time just under normal circumstances, quote-unquote normal, whatever that is. So maybe there needs to be some resources that we could, and I'd be happy to explore that from a HEMA perspective if we can be of any help.
Do you mean beyond date of service?
Well, no, not necessarily. I'm just thinking For treatment that occurred prior to the date of service. Yes, I'm talking about that. Not just to have a long period of time.
I do want to clarify what I heard earlier is that, you know, there will be sort of runout, but runout is driven by date of service.
Yeah, in the pipeline.
It's not processing date of service after October 1 that you're going to do dual. That, I don't think that was the context.
Correct? Could you clarify that?
Okay, thank you.
Sorry.
I
didn't mean to confuse it any further. I'm in agreement. I think there might be confusion out there, quote unquote, that it would be helpful for us as a group, for the committee and for stakeholders to assist in making that clarification so people understand that point.
Any other comments from maybe providers or payers about what's going to happen?
Walter, could I inject in that for a second? I think that the critical thing is going to be how is this going to get communicated throughout the industry, and this is someplace, if we had a one-stop shop that's kind of heard talk about, where people could say, let me go look and see if this payer has had to revert back to 9 and I have to code as 9 if I'm a provider. How will the providers know that the payer ran into a problem and had to pull their code out and back off for a few minutes, and maybe the payer's contingency is just hold your claims for 5 days so we can fix this, and we're going to put it back in again. How can we have that? I mean, is there a place where we can capture that information where payers could report to the providers if they're having any issues with their implementation, or the clearinghouse, or the providers could report in that they're having a problem with their software to let people know? Is this something you guys could explore to give a one place for communicating any issues following 10-1?
Yeah, I think that is one of the opportunities I see, is really ensuring that there's a strong communication mechanism and sort of facilitated mechanism to communicate. I mean, health plans and providers, others, they all should think about how they communicate this and maybe have a jello button, to call it some way, you know, to talk about blue buttons and other things. A jello button on the screen that says ICD-10, and you just click on it as a provider and see what is the latest things about ICD-10, something like that.
First, on Debbie's point, we've actually talked about that at Weedy, but having Weedy create sort of a repository of readiness, which would include payers, clearinghouses, potentially vendors. And we've got some buy-in from some of the payers. And, again, it could be a living type of document. You could have the readiness, and then once you transition, you could have the contingency planning. But that raises an issue, and the dual coding raises an issue. Let's just say Rob, in his wisdom, decided to move in that direction. You could make it mandatory on the commercial plans, right? It would be an option for them. So now, as a provider, again, different from all of the other HIPAA transitions, you're sitting in front of your patients. You've almost got to know not just what health plan they're with, but what particular product they're using, because each product will have not only potentially a different contingency plan, but they could have a different set of payment policies and a different level of specificity. And no one's talking about this, but it revolves around what physician documents and what code you select. So if health plan A says, oh, don't worry, dual coding is fine, great, you can put in a 9 code. But if it's another plan, then you're out of luck. So I think there's got to be an industry agreement around it. It can't be by payer, or else it's going to be a disaster. From the provider perspective as well, as the old saying, cash is king. And the contingency plans are all revolving around making sure that the operation continues. And so what we're telling our guys is assume the absolute worst in every link in the chain. So if your coder's not ready, who do you have on staff? Maybe you've got a second person who's not maybe as expert, but could fill in a moment's notice. You're telling your staff no vacation time around October 1st. I mean, as strange as it sounds, you've got to say, hey, nobody's going anywhere. But also, you've got to realize that even a small practice, let's say 5 physicians, their operating budget for the month might be in the $1 million range, which means they need contingency plans that include lines of credit, and they need cash on hand. And you say, oh, no problem. But today's environment is different than 10 years ago. It's not as easy for a physician to go to the local bank and say, I need a $1 million line of credit. And so they need to add that to their long list of people to talk to find out, can we get that line of credit? Is it accessible? And if not, what are we going to do? And then the idea is, what if you get to the point where the vendor just says, I'm sorry, we tried, we just couldn't make it. Or, yes, you're going to get your upgrade, and it'll be ready November 1st. Well, you've got to have a backup plan. And it's easy to say, well, just go down to Best Buy and get yourself some software and install it, or use the CMS one. Oh, it's wonderful. Well, that's for CMS. You know, that's not necessarily going to work for other payers. And to think that a provider is going to get on a DDD portal and enter in all their claims is just not realistic. It's going to drive down productivity. And so we've got to be thinking, again, about trying to push the vendors harder than we have. And, again, we hope that if we can get the certification process off the ground, that will be a catalyst.
Thank you. Any other comments?
So I would, having also been through every single HIPAA implementation, our experience has been that the private payers seem to be a little bit more fluid with the way that they treat the providers, at least the physicians. That's been our experience. Medicare has been a little bit more of a challenge, and I think one of the pleas I would make today is to have the MAC staff up on the contractor service lines. I mean, we need a huge bandwidth. Like, open it up, train them early, and because what's going to happen is they are going to flood your lines. And when they're done flooding your lines and not being able to get through for 2 hours, that's when they start calling me and Rob. And it's really fun because you get like 30 calls a day, and then we start developing, you know, complaint forms, and we push them off to OESS, and then we get board like Gladys involved, and it's much more of a, you know, a blunt way to address these things. But I mean, we pretty much have a workaround for this because they will bottleneck, and so we'll feed them. And I think I'd like to get the Humana's information, because we need to make those connections on the private side. But I mean, I know how to navigate Medicare pretty well, but do you really want everyone going through me and Rob? Like, it is sort of like a funnel, but it's really not the best way to approach it. I mean, so I think that if you can staff up on the MAC lines, just know you're going to get like a tremendous flood, and maybe make them open longer. Don't tell people to call it Sunday at like 4 a.m. Like, that's not helpful. But but that, I mean, so you see what I'm saying? Like, just open them up. So, I mean, we'll continue to, you know, work with you guys to try and, this is the only way we know how to do it. I mean, I don't know how, because I've been to this rodeo a number of times. And so what would a doctor do? They would literally stand their head to do whatever it takes to get paid. I'm not going to lie. If it means dropping a paper, it's a worst-case scenario, they'll do it. If it means using, I would argue this is not necessarily a solution, free billing software, assuming that the problem's not with Medicare, because it doesn't matter what software you have, if the problem's on the Medicare side or the other payer side, it's like you just can't get through. So, but they would do whatever it took, and they don't, I'm not the first point of like, they don't pick up the phone to us. We're like a moment of desperation, like when they can't figure out and they call their congressperson or, I mean, a little bit kind of comes to that. So I think that, you know, to the degree that we can have a little more, you know, if there's maybe a technical assistance line available for Medicare, because we're going to have problems. So I think it's just making sure that bottleneck is just not so narrow.
Thanks for that. Yes, sir.
Couple of points. Just going to pick up a little bit with what Merrill was saying about items that are in the pipeline. Obviously, items that are for services that occur prior to October 1st oftentimes have to be resubmitted. They may have to be resubmitted after October 1st. Consistency of policy in terms of how you deal with that is important. From a coding perspective, you've already coded the claim once. And so an I-9 code, even though that claim is for services prior to October 1st, should be processed with I-9 codes because that was in effect at the time. And the health plan should have the capability of taking it in as an I-9 code and not rejecting it because of that. So that's number one. Number two, I was encouraged to hear about tools that might be available from CMS. I'm not sure direct data entry is the best way to deal with it, but I'd like to see more of that sort of thing occur. You know, if I ran the world, I probably would say, if you didn't do testing early enough, you should basically add 6 more months of dual support as a health plan until you basically demonstrate that you've got the capability of handling that volume of test claims. So, and I'm glad to hear we're talking earlier about maybe some sensitivity of supporting both because I think there are going to be some very small providers who for whatever reason, aren't going to be ready. The question is, what type of tools are there going to be? But the other thing is, obviously, diagnosis codes really feed a lot of information for a lot of organizations. Medicare uses them basically to reevaluate how they carve up inpatient DRGs at a later date. So the question is the window. So you've got several months, and then you got a new inpatient PPS rule coming out the following year in mid-May.
what type of data are they going to use in the following year? So the question still is reliability of data, and I'm sensitive to the productivity issue because for our purposes, the date is the date is the date, and dual coding is expensive. And that, you know, we either make the switch and hope that everybody is ready at that point in time, but I also think there needs to be some sensitivity and provided with tools either to allow somebody who isn't ready the opportunity to convert it to a 10 code as part of that process.
Thanks, George. Jim, and then...
Okay, from Weedy's perspective, we've heard all sorts of stories, and of course, no one wants to say that we plan to violate the regulations, so they're all going to only use the proper codes at the proper times. But a lot of organizations are saying, well, what if something changes? So they've built in some capabilities to go with a 9 or 10, depending on how the regulations work at that point in time. Others have said, we have things like portals, workarounds, things like that. Not just the payers, but some of the dual clearinghouses or vendors provide a capability for a provider to go in there and either provide supplemental information about what the code might be or to actually select the code from potentially a gem list or some other list to say, I know I sent you something with a 9, you're my business associate, I would like to fix it, give me some options, and they pick the right code so that really submitting 9s or submitting a 10 when a claim actually gets generated. There's a whole variety of things people are looking at. I know in some payers, they don't even use a diagnosis for the physician's claims. It's just a CPT-based reimbursement. So it comes in, they may say, okay, it got some kind of a code, whether it's a decent one, bad one, whether it has Greek letters in it or whatever, just ignore it and say, bad edit, but I'll pass it through. So not really using I-9s, or right? They're just not even using them, period. So that may be an option for some of those as well. So it's just a whole gamut. I think it depends on the entity itself. Also depends on the type of claim coming through. There's so many factors in there. Say one type of contingency is the right way to go is not really it. The answer. There's a whole bunch of potential contingencies out there. As we say, risk mitigation. And a lot of them are ugly. But there's going to be some pain in here. But I don't think there's a perfect solution that says this is the way everybody can do it and it's going to work perfectly. But we're hearing a lot of stories, especially outside of public meetings.
Thank you. Thanks.
So I'm probably just going to summarize here, but just to kind of reiterate what's already been said. First, in terms of the idea of a place where health plans can go and kind of talk about their policies, with regard to pre-authorization and other questions come up with ICD-10, I think the Weedy Success Initiative is a great place to start. It comes from industry. CMS is partnering with it, and certainly that is, I think, an excellent fix for that. And then in terms of risk management and mitigation, right, risk management is things that we think that we can control and we can have a direct impact on that, you know, decreasing the risk. Risk mitigation is doing what we can, right? We think about this daily, right? And one of the risks out there is providers not being ready. Just to summarize, some of the tools we're thinking about for risk mitigation in terms of that risk, which are already available, are things that we've already talked about, going to paper claims, the portals, the billing software, AMA, as I mentioned, advanced payments. We're investigating that, and certainly the policy on advanced payments right now is that if it's CMS's fault, then certainly advanced payments is an option to go for. Beyond that, in terms of, you know, it was a provider who couldn't do it, or a provider is a vendor who couldn't do it, or whatever the case may be, that's a little bit difficult, and I probably don't need to reiterate this, but CMS we are taking care of taxpayers' money, right? And so therefore there's the philosophical wall that we have to steward. Thank you. We're the stewards of the taxpayers' money, so there's your philosophical wall. Nevertheless, we're exploring that as an option and seeing what we can do with that regard. I do want to say, what is pretty much off the table, certainly delaying the date is off the table. And I'm just saying that in all of our discussions of risk mitigation at every level that we're discussing this, this is never brought up. Delaying the data is never brought up. The second part of that is the concept of dual processing, that as both a regulator and as CMS the payer, is pretty much off the table, because if you hear about what's being talked about, Rob made good points, we're not helping the transition at all by dual processing if only 10% of the plans are doing it, or if only CMS does it and nobody else does it. I mean, that just confuses it, and it'll push off any successful transition. And so that idea of ICD-10 switching on a date of service, difficult though it is, there's been many, many discussions at this table for the last 8 years about why it had to happen that way and why you can't fold things in from a regional standpoint or fold things in from a date standpoint. So enforcement discretion, dual processing, it's just not a viable option because of the cost, and I think Sid could probably talk about that, the cost involved, and that it doesn't actually help the transition. So I think what we're looking at is risk mitigation and looking at as many different tools as Jim alluded to, as many different tools as we can get to if we come to day one and provider's not ready. And I think what Rob pointed out is actually a great reason why we should get out and advertise these tools, because these tools are not a lot of fun. So if you say, okay, it's all right, October 1st, you don't have to transition to ICD-10 because you can do all your stuff on paper. Hopefully that's frightening enough to say, okay, well, let's save some time here, and these are the mitigating factors that I can do, is switch to paper or start to feed one by one through a portal. So I think we need to talk about that. We need to advertise it and say, here's the things you can do if you're not ready on October 1st. And I think that would actually be effective in pushing people that way. So thank you.
I think Sid has.
Oh, I'm sorry, Sid.
I would like to enter into the public record that my new BFF is Matthew. I grew up in large-scale integration and Six Sigma world, so the way you ring down problems is to do it quickly, because if you spread them out, they basically clone new problems. And I think for this industry to take on something this aggressive, to embark on any strategy that would elongate our ring down time is a very painful and the cost is probably not calculable today. So I suggest we stay as close to our plan as possible, avoiding some catastrophe that we can't even probably speak of here. So staying on the date, I think, is an imperative. Secondly, from a small physician perspective, Jim Daly has an outstanding point. We use the diagnosis code to validate the benefit. Beyond that, the payment is based on the service content, which will be a CPT, rev code, HCPCS, or whatever. So I don't see the payment stream at risk for the professional side of the house if we can get a valid diagnosis code. The third observation I will make is a physician is not dealing with 185,000 combined codes. He's dealing with a set that is specific to his line of business. Now, most practices that I've been in as a consumer have some kind of tick sheet. You go in, I got a cough, got a fever, check, 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 and it gets coded. That's really the problem that we're dealing with for a lot of the smaller practices, and I think that is very manageable. To turn it into something where we're trying to assume what might have been met in order to get things paid, not based explicitly on the code submitted to us, is probably the wrong strategy. And my last comment is, it's always more desirable, or at least it feels better, to say, well, we could just delay a little bit. Well, delays a little bit on things of this magnitude turn into delays pretty extensive. In the payer world, in our world specifically, and we only have two adjudicators. There are other payers out there that have many more than two. We are dealing with somewhere in the vicinity of 30 million codes that are embedded in our systems that are configuration items. Either it defines a benefit plan, it defines a contract carve-out, or some edit, and I'm sure CMS has a similar situation. To keep those current in a dual mode is absolutely not practical. So we may conclude that it would be in everybody's best interest to prolong the pain, but quite frankly, very quickly, payers will not be able to effectively, correctly calculate. And it's going to be insidious. It's going to be a slowly atrophying of the capability. It's not going to be something that's going to be overt and immediate. So my recommendation is that in our current strategy is to follow CMS guidelines. Thank you very much, Matthew. And look at every element of our organization where we can put in a contingency plan or a specific set of business conditions. That's what we're doing.
Thank you. Thanks for those comments. Oh, yeah. We have no 5 minutes.
Can
we have
Actually, what I was going to ask, Matthew already took care of. I was going to ask, let's get rid of some ambiguity. You know, let's what we're not going to do, I think, Jim, you nailed both. We're not going to extend the date, and we're not going to allow dual processing for 9 and 10. So I'll flip the question around and say, then what specifically might we be able to do to address those smaller practices, okay, and I've heard from you, Sid and Jim, that a lot of these practices are professional, you know, the providers, so they're billing using CPT today, by and large. However, there are some, right? And if we can be a lot more specific, that way we can come up with a contingency plan for those who are not going to make it. Because, you know, as of this point, whatever percentage is, if their vendors aren't ready, they're not going to be ready. Therefore, the contingency plan. So I'd love to hear from